Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I am delighted that we still have an audience on this third installment of this series on sudden cardiac death, what everyone should know. It has been a pleasure for me personally to be here. Dirk Blom on Monday tell us about the problem of cholesterol leading to coronary artery disease and sudden death. And yesterday, the really marvelous talk and story given by Peter Schwartz, who was there when the story evolved. And today, we will be touching on the issue of heart muscle disease or cardiomyopathies. The central problem, of course, is that these conditions, they all lead to a disturbance in the heart rhythm, and they lead to that lethal rhythm called ventricular fibrillation, where the heart is just going very fast, it's chaotic, and is unable to pump effectively, leading a person to collapse. And if the ventricular fibrillation is not rescued in a matter of a few minutes, then it is a fatal condition. So we're looking at different roads leading to that central problem of ventricular fibrillation and sudden death. Now, when we talk among ourselves in the hospital, we like to speak in Greek so that no one understands us. So instead of saying heart muscle disease, we say cardiomyopathy, all taken, stringed along from Greek origins, cardia for heart, muscle for muscle, and pathos for suffering. It all means heart muscle disease, and that is the issue that I will be focusing on today. And I'm showing you here examples of specimens of the heart cut in cross-section. Here in the middle is a post-mortem specimen of a normal heart, which has got this shape, elongated, conical shape, with the left ventricle, the main pumping chamber of the heart, being the dominant chamber, and the right ventricle being a lot smaller. And that is the right atrium there, and blood flows from the lungs into the left atrium and into the ventricle here and out in the aorta into the body. And of course, blood from the rest of the body is coming back into the right atrium, right ventricle, and then flows into the lungs to get oxygen, and then comes back and be pumped that way. What do you see on either side of this good-looking heart with a large cavity? The walls are appropriate. The whole configuration is normal. You see two very abnormal hearts on either side, which illustrate what this problem of heart muscle disease causes. It actually has two effects on the heart. It disturbs the structure, right? So you can see here that the heart on your left, which we call hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the walls are markedly thickened, and the cavity you can see is almost a slither. So that's a problem from a structure point of view. And the one that we call dilated cardiomyopathy, you can see now that the heart is almost like a ball, it's globular. So the structure is abnormal, all the chambers are big, are enlarged, are dilated. You can see the main pumping chamber is seen very well, even the right ventricle is seen very well, the atria are very large. So cardiomyopathy disturbs the structure, it also disturbs the function. And what happens in these people, in fact, with this thickened heart, their hearts are very, very strong. They almost have a heart of an ox. You know, it contracts very, very strongly, in fact. A supranormal heart, thick and supranormal. Whereas these people who develop these hearts that dilate, the hearts are feeble and beating very, very weakly. And so the structure and function are disturbed, and we call that situation heart muscle disease, particularly when we've ruled out other abnormalities in the structure, in the heart. So we've ruled out coronary disease, we've ruled out valve disease, we've ruled out disorders of the pericardium causing disturbances of the heart. Is when we have eliminated the other abnormalities to the heart that we then call it a cardiomyopathy. The one that we see, in fact, quite commonly in the hospital, because With it almost a slow, a slow process of getting to meet your maker here. You know, it takes a bit of time so that there's an opportunity for people to come into the hospital. And in the hospital, we often see people with this problem of dilated cardiomyopathy, the feeble and large heart that was on your right. And we try, in fact, to make sure that there isn't something reversible that we can find, such as alcohol, which, in fact, is the biggest culprit. All right, and often when our patients come to see us for the first time, they of course don't drink, and then the second visit, it's just a tort that I take a week, and then the story dribbles, and I do, usually is of course to talk to the wife, and then you get the story. After 6 months, you really get the story, and you realize that it is the alcohol, and in fact, if you can stop that alcohol early, firstly, you stop progression of the problem, and in fact, some people may even recover, provided there has not been extensive heart muscle damage from the alcohol. Very important. There is also actually a paradoxical problem that occurs in pregnancy. Towards the end of pregnancy or the first 5 months following pregnancy, some people develop dilated hearts, right? And there's nothing to explain it except for the fact that they were pregnant. It's an enigma. We don't know why that is. And we do see it in our communities. It does appear, though, that perhaps poverty might have something to do with it, because poorer communities, and maybe nutrition, we don't know. There are a whole host of theories about pregnancy-associated dilated cardiomyopathy, obviously a devastating condition because there's a young mother with a young family. And then this is also a very important entity to recognize. It does sound like the maker gave us a certain allotment of beats that we must have in our lifetime. Some people have said it's 3 billion. After you've exhausted those, then, you know, it's time to shuffle off. Now, if your heart, all of us in this room, runs at a rate of 150 beats per minute for at least 6 months, right? It should normally be, you know, half of that. At the end of that 6 months, we will see the heart starting to dilate, all right? And if a person gets into that abnormal rhythm for long enough, it seems that the heart dilates, the cells die, and your fibrosis, and that then becomes a problem. Again, something important to recognize early, so that by just treating now the fast rhythm, we can always map it and burn it, you know, we map it and zap it and stop it, right? We might stop you from developing this particular problem. Infection is important, right? So influenza, right, can in fact go on to cause what we call a myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart, and then the heart also becomes flabby and feeble. That picture, a significant proportion of these people often recover, but some of them go on to a chronic condition. We're recognizing now more and more that actually there's a component of these people who just come with unexplained big hearts, where it's actually an inherited condition. It seems to be applying to about a quarter of everyone who comes with unexplained dilated cardiomyopathy. And in this case, we usually look at the family to try to look for other evidence of a genetic effect, including genetic studies. But there is a great, there's still a proportion of people where really we haven't got a cause. And to hide our ignorance, we say to you, you've got idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, so that we sound quite knowledgeable and confident. Actually, we mean we just don't know what is happening. Okay, that's what it means. This condition that's called idiopathic is becoming a smaller and smaller group, fortunately, because now of the powerful methods of investigation that we are able to apply, particularly molecular genetic analysis. So this is the problem. And as I said, these people present with a slowly developing illness, fatigue for several weeks, shortness of breath, swelling of the body, right? What used to be called dropsy, you know, that you develop, you know, the whole body might swell if you don't go and see the doctor soon enough. We recognize those symptoms as symptoms of heart failure. So effort intolerance, swelling of the body in the context of an abnormal heart, we say that is heart failure. The entity of heart failure is a very serious condition when you've got that, those constellation of symptoms and signs. And in some senses, is even worse than cancer. I'm showing you here a comparison of survival of people with various types of cancer as well as heart failure. You can see here in this particular study that was in the British Medical Journal in 2000 that
the outcomes for people with breast cancer, on average, you'd expect that 72% would still be alive at 3 years. A metastatic prostatic cancer, when it has spread, it is obviously a lethal condition. But if you look at heart failure, just in 1 year, we often have lost a third of the individuals, particularly if we do not deploy more effective interventions, which I will show you. And by 3 years, you can see that, the survivors are a quarter. You know, so what a serious diagnosis to have when you're told that you've got heart failure. What can we, how do we diagnose it? There are many ways, but the more recent method is what is called magnetic resonance imaging. And I'm showing you here some photographs or some scans from MRI, where you can see here the vertebrae at the back, that is the chest, these are the lungs, and this is a heart over the diaphragm here, so we can see the pumping chambers of the heart. The beauty of magnetic resonance imaging, it is that it is a one-stop shop that tells you abnormalities of structure, abnormalities of function. We can even look to see whether there is inflammation, myocarditis, by giving you contrast and seeing whether the contrast is trapped there and so on. And we not only look at structure and function, we can also look at the coronary arteries. And as you can see, we can turn the person around and see actually all sides of the heart using this particular technique. And it is the bee's knees in this field now in terms of imaging. You know, it's where it's at. And at Kruske, I can tell you that we're continuing to innovate in this space, and some of our work with engineers and the physicists to develop new ways of using this technique of magnetic resonance imaging to detect structural heart disease and other abnormalities. What do we do if you have got a cardiomyopathy? We obviously first try pills, and we've got basically two types. We've got the ones that are very important to people coming to us, because people are coming because of swelling, so we must give them water pills to get rid of the water. Digitalis, which is an old treatment, is still good in keeping people feeling good and not wanting to come to hospital because of symptoms. But of course, we're increasingly having treatments that prolong life. All right, I showed you outcomes at 3 years in the year 2000. All right, that was actually before we realized that beta blockers are very good for people with heart failure, coming back to that issue of reducing the number of beats that you are expending, because beta blockers lower your heart rate. Okay, they lower your heart rate, buy you time, and they prolong life. They are one of the best things that has happened in this field. So much so that people who are on heart transplant waiting lists, who get on beta blockers, are coming off the list, and we're ending up having transplant surgeons now touting for patients, because they're looking for business, because this has just been so effective. Of course, some people fail treatments. And as you know, it was here in Cape Town where treatment for end-stage heart failure was pioneered. I'm showing you here Dr. Philip Blyberg and Barnard following the operation. And this great story, of course, is that Dr. Blyberg was the second heart transplant patient. He is, in fact, the patient who gave doctors confidence and society that actually this works. We know that Louis Washkansky lived for 18 days, right, following the operation. So there was a bit of a worry that the surgeons might be acting as an executioner here, right? So that there was a bit of a worry. But you know, Blyberg, when he was operated, he lived for nearly 2 years, right? And in fact, he was a very good advert for heart transplantation because he, following discharge from hospital, he was already swimming, right? And his wife was complaining that she can't cope with him. You know, he was so energetic. And this was actually fantastic. Following this operation, the transplant business just spread and established it as a very effective treatment, which is now routine. Big problem, of course, is that we have not got enough organs to go around. and therefore other ways are necessary. And here I'm showing you what sometimes is necessary if someone needs a transplant but we have not got an organ. We can use devices now, left ventricular assist devices, which are built as pumps that assist the heart in its work. So this is the heart, that's the main pumping chamber of the heart, the left ventricle, and that's the aorta taking blood to the rest of the body. And what you can see here is that this pump here is taking blood out of the left ventricle and then using its own pump mechanism to push the blood into the circulation. And of course, it is battery powered and so on. And the technology here has moved to the point where these are quite miniaturized now, can be embedded rather unobtrusively. And to the extent that people now have said that this is destination therapy. It's no longer a bridge to transplantation. This is the treatment itself. And what we've discovered, of course, is that when we rest the heart in a certain number of people, the heart recovers. Right? The heart itself recovers. And the person, after 2 to 3 years of having this backup pump, now we can take it off and they actually go on to have a good life. So there are options now for people with the problem of dilated cardiomyopathy. You might well ask, why is this relevant in a talk about sudden cardiac death? It is, in fact, very relevant because these people with this illness of swelling of the body, shortness of breath, actually, the majority of them die suddenly. The majority of them die suddenly, probably on the basis of ventricular fibrillation. So much so that even in this group of people, the implantable cardioverter defibrillator is used once you say you reach a certain level of severity, so that should you have VF, ventricular fibrillation, then you've got this the ICD, which I will just show you a cartoon of to remind you of what Dirk and as well as Professor Schwartz showed earlier in the day. So we've got options to keep people alive, and it is no longer a death sentence, really, provided you receive the appropriate level of care. Now, what about this other cardiomyopathy that is almost an opposite of this large, feeble heart with dilated cardiomyopathy that gives you a slow-going illness that often ends abruptly? What about this other problem or condition where I say that actually the heart is hyperfunctioning? You know, it is really working very hard. The systolic function is supranormal in a context of a thick heart. I think you'll remember that song of Johnny Clegg about being a young ox, you know, or as in Zulu they put it, a young ox, right? Yeah, a young ox. Why do these people come into trouble? The problem was illustrated, and maybe some of you in the audience might even have been watching this match 10 years ago now, which was taking place in Lyon in France. It was the Confederation Cup semi-final between Cameroon and Colombia. And as you know, the Confederation Cup is the cup that is played by the continental champions, right? Cameroon were the African champions, and Colombia was representing its continent. And this Cameroonian international, Marc Vivien Foe, he died suddenly at the 72nd minute. And apparently the audience, although I never know really how to confirm this, they say that there are 1 billion people who are watching this match. It is really a high-profile match. And this catastrophic event occurred, and Marc Vivien Foe, in fact, attempts to resuscitate him failed, and then after 45 minutes, he was declared dead. Now, Marc Vivien Foe was, in fact, a seasoned international. He started his career in about 1993. And in fact, his last transfer fee from West Ham to the club in Lyon was £6 million. All right. So he was a really prized international who was subjected, obviously, to a lot of medical tests. Okay, each time he was being transferred, and in fact, each time he would be examined for a transfer. Okay. The doctors would sort of hesitate a little bit because they would do an ECG and the ECG would look bizarre. And then the doctors would talk to the other doctor, and then they'd convince themselves that, look, you know, he's from Africa, you know. This must be an African variant. That would not hurt. The coaches and so on are interested in the transfer. You know, the doctors must certify that the footballer is fit to go on. So those doubts following the screening were never actually pursued to the level that they should have. Mark Vivian Foe had hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, all right? And he had two children who have been screened, and several siblings, and with the expectation, of course, would be that at least 50% of them would have the condition, because it is a condition that is inherited in an autosomally dominant fashion, as I will show you. But of course, the issue that was illustrated by Mark Vivian Foe is actually not an uncommon problem, right? More recently, there was this issue of the triathletes who died suddenly, right? And we know that people run the Comrades Marathon, and every now and again, people die suddenly. The question is, what could be the cause? And this is an important study, because it is a study of 387 Mark Vivian Foes who died suddenly and were subjected to post-mortem, right? So they came to post-mortem so that we can try to determine what could be going wrong. It turns out that 70% of the reasons for dying suddenly are here. The number one reason is, in fact, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? So in a young person who's under the age of 35, who dies in that situation, in the dinner party, you can always speculate that's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy until proven otherwise, and you will be right in a younger person. There is that entity called commotio cordis, right, which is a problem that happens when usually a teenager is hit by a mobile object over the heart, and if it strikes at a sensitive time in that electrocardiogram, it triggers ventricular fibrillation, and you could die quite suddenly. This, for example, is not uncommon in baseball, right? In baseball, where it dies, and sometimes in karate, right, where this happens. And it's not, can you see, 20%, it explains that group. Coronary anomalies, as Dirk showed you, sometimes that the coronary artery arises from the wrong side, from the pulmonary artery, and is supplying the deoxygenated bad blood to the main pumping chamber of the heart, which means that it has got limited reserve should you go into exercise, and then that sets up ventricular fibrillation. We also do know that people in the community with bigger hearts who do not necessarily have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy are also at risk for left ventricular hypertrophy. And then this is well known, that when you exercise during the midst of a flu-like illness, you put yourself at risk. And the reason that is so is because of the problem of myocardial inflammation, myocarditis, that leads to this. A lot of people think this is the number one cause. It is an important one, contributing to 5%, but hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a major problem. There are other forms of cardiomyopathy here. As you can see, dilated cardiomyopathy is in this. There's another cardiomyopathy affecting only the right side of the heart. And when you put the cardiomyopathy together, they are, in fact, the leading problem in about a third of young people under the age of 35 who die suddenly whilst exercising. Coming back to the story of Mark Vivian Foe, when his family was analyzed, this is the pattern that was observed. As you can see in this multi-generational pedigree here, we represent the males in blocks and the females in circles, and then the circles that are filled in are those individuals who are affected with this condition. You can see here that the person who introduced this gene in this family is the great-grandmother here. It was passed to the son, who then passed it to two of the three children, and then and so on and so on. The main point, of course, being that because it's a dominant condition, you just need one copy, one faulty copy of the gene to manifest with the disease. And if this great-grandmother is passing on the gene, then each child has got a 50-50 chance of getting that abnormal copy. This person, of course, got it. These ones were quite lucky. Normally, we see a pattern of about 50% in an autosomally dominant condition that affects both males and females. The interesting thing, of course, is that the people who die suddenly from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy are actually usually the males. Okay? And the reason for that is because of the sport issue. Okay? It's because of the trigger issue. Right? So the ladies do well by not exerting themselves too much in these types of endeavors. And of course, as I said, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is almost always genetic. It's a genetic condition. So I'm showing you a cell here. And as you know, the DNA, which is the blueprint, is in the nucleus. And what I've done here, I've unwound the DNA to show you the ladder. To show you the ladder, and the ladder is a double helix, okay? So this side of the ladder you got from your mother, this one you got from your father. And you know that very simple and elegant design that is based just on four letters, you know, the A, C, T, G. And you've got 3 billion of these, just four letters that keep being swapped around. And that's just, they code for life. Right, yeah? Triplets of them, when you string them together, they code for these amino acids. So there's 20 amino acids, depending on the condition. Very, very simple, very, very elegant. The only problem, of course, is that if you've got this spelling error, okay, that you get from your parent in the wrong gene, right? It turns out that the genes that code for the molecule, for the proteins that are the motors of the cell that cause the cell to contract, right, are the ones that lead to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So you've got a faulty gene there because of this spelling error just from one of your parents, so you don't need copies on both sides. When you have a faulty error from both your parents, that's when we talk about a recessive condition, right? Yeah, where both genes are faulty, and recessive conditions are usually much more severe, presenting much earlier in life, and so on. Whereas these more autosomally dominant conditions are compatible with a person reproducing. You often reproduce before you die, and which is why these conditions that are dominant are the same in all world populations, because the mutation rate of the human species is the same for all of us. So these ones that live for long enough for us to reproduce tend to be common. So there's no reason to believe that the Africans will not have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, such as was the error that was made in the case of Mark Vivian Foe. The problem there, of course, with that heart that is thickened is that you have a problem of obstruction of flow and then compounding the flow situation in addition to the VF leading to the death. And as I said, the normal flow of blood in the heart here, shown in this cartoon, is that it comes to the right side, right atrium, and then it goes up in the pulmonary artery to go to the lungs to be oxygenated, and then comes back into the left atrium, and then has to travel. And there's a highway here, which we call the left ventricular outflow tract. It's an autobahn, you know, where the blood must flow unobstructed, right? And there must be no speed limit, and it must be quite clear. Now, the problem that occurs in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is that because of the thickening of this septum here, it narrows the autobahn. So the left atrial tract is very, very narrowed. And on top of that, the mitral valve leaflet is touching, it's almost touching. So that when the heart contracts, it goes into contraction, instead of blood going where it should go, aorta up, it actually goes back into the atrium. It regurgitates back. Really big problem, right? And you can imagine now, when you're exercising, you lose fluid, the cavity becomes smaller, you exacerbate this problem, and then you set up a problem of ischemia, because the blood that comes out of the aorta is the blood that must supply your heart, right? And then you have that problem now of blood not going there, get ischemic, and then you set up ventricular fibrillation, and then you come into that problem of death. And as you've seen already from, I think all of us have been careful to show you examples of ventricular fibrillation. So this is ECG that is running normally, and this person goes into a very rapid rate, we call it ventricular tachycardia initially, and then subsequently degenerates into this chaos. This was captured in someone with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy who had an implantable cardioverter defibrillator that was monitoring what was happening. We also know that people with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and even in the general population, the bigger your heart, the higher risk of sudden unexpected death, and this is one of the factors that we use to re-stratify people. And a person who has not even had symptoms, who's detected, for example, just on an insurance examination, who turns out to have this thickening of the heart with this very high risk of sudden death, we often say you just need an implantable defibrillator even before you have anything, any symptoms, because the first symptom might be death. Okay, so that's how we re-stratify people in this particular context. You may well ask, what do we do to relieve the obstruction caused by that thickened septum? We can do one of two things. Clearly, we can operate on you, right, and cut out that thick muscle. It's called myectomy, right? Yes, so it's an open surgical operation. There is a newer approach, because some people refuse to have their chest cracked. They say, no, doctor, have you got an alternative? And then some doctors thought of a very clever alternative, which is say, okay, what we will do, we will go to identify the blood vessel, the artery supplying that thickened muscle. So we'll go and identify it by means of angiography, and then we will inject alcohol down that artery to cause it to go into spasm, give you a myocardial infarct. This is a designer infarct, okay? That is directed to that specific point, right? Yeah, and then we give you a heart attack, right? In that place, muscle that you don't need, it shrivels up, right? It opens up the autobahn, all right? And then flow is restored, okay? So there are those two approaches. There is a huge debate among us as to which is better. Personally, actually, I prefer the knife, okay? Because this alcohol tends to go down to more places than it's required and results in other complications such as heart block. You need a pacemaker now because it went on to affect the electricity of the heart. So there's a huge contest as to which one you go for. I advise my patients still to go for the knife rather than the designer infarct. What can we do to prevent a person from dying suddenly? Drugs are an option, but actually moderately effective. The key advance has been the implantable cardioverter defibrillator in this problem of sudden cardiac death. And as Dirk pointed out, it is applicable in whatever condition leads to VF. Okay, coronary artery disease, once you've got damage and you are likely to have VF, it helps. In long QT last night, we heard it's also important. And even here, implanting a cardioverter defibrillator is important. As you can see here, it is like a pacemaker that is inserted just behind the left breast. And then we just put a wire into the blood vessels and push that wire into the heart. And then it then monitors the activity of the heart. And should there be abnormal heart rhythm, it then delivers a shock. And in fact, we've got an example here. One of our patients with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, 33-year-old man, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, sleeping. Right. And the reason it was implanted was because the heart was just too thick. He fell into that high-risk group. And so, as you can see, so this is normal rhythm. He goes very fast. He's sleeping. Okay, fine. And then what this shows you is that after these few bits, because we program this thing to wait before it starts an examination, because we don't want it to be shocking you each time you are excited, okay? So you must wait a little bit, and then it's starting an examination now. Hey, it looks like there's a problem, and then it starts an examination there, and then as the rhythm is becoming serious now, it's degenerating into VF, it delivers a shock, okay? The person is sleeping, and then can you see how sinus rhythm is restored, right? Yeah. So I mean, the person would have died, essentially, right? Okay. Because you're busy sleeping there, and they would have woken up the next morning, and the person would have been said, the person died of natural causes. So the person's life was saved, and there is no doubt that these interventions are very, very effective in this situation. So, in terms of cardiomyopathy, at this stage, we can't cure it. So, we cannot remove it at this stage. But there's been quite a lot of progress with respect to treatment, and the treatments definitely prolong life and enhance the quality of life. And the new genetic discoveries are, of course, the great hope that maybe we might in some day design treatments for people, right? By knowing the cause, maybe genetic engineering would reach a stage when we can remove, screen everybody when they are born. You know, the ones with this abnormal faulty gene, we just conduct some, send some nano robots, to go and cut out those spelling errors, put in the right letter, and go away. That's going to happen, you know, at some point. Maybe not in your lifetime, but perhaps in mine. you know, there's hope for some of us that will happen. Yeah. But the great saving grace is the issue of screening, all right? Yeah, it's the issue of screening, right? Is that we can, in fact, detect these cardiomyopathies early through screening because they cause a detectable structural and functional abnormality of the heart. So screening is really key. And that probably is the takeaway message of this whole series that we've been discussing, is the issue of screening. And there is a consensus, both by the European Society of Cardiology as well as the International Olympic Committee, that cardiac screening, for example, is required in any young person who's participating in competitive sport. Okay? Right? Just competitive sport, okay? You know, the person must be screened. Now, sport itself is actually not the problem, right? So sport is good, right? So there's no problem. The problem, of course, is that the sudden death occurs in someone who's got an abnormality, an undetected abnormality. Then sport, but then it serves as a trigger, right? That triggers ventricular fibrillation. Okay, so that is the basis, and screening is actually simple, right? It's simple. It is simple in the sense that we can diagnose a lot of cardiac abnormalities by using what is called an electrocardiogram, all right? And we must do the electrocardiogram, and we do need a cardiologist, right, to read it, so that we can know whether it is normal or not. And then the issue of a sonar as part of screening is actually optional. It's not mandatory. So the electrocardiogram is mandatory because in the context of heart muscle disease, as well as coronary disease, as well as long QT, we will pick it up on the ECG, the good old ECG that is now about 100 years old. And definitely, if there has been a young sudden death in a family, right, it's a young death, the survivors should seek screening. She should see. So there's no doubt about that. And this applies whether someone has died during athletic activity or not. Okay, a sudden unexpected death in a young person mandates that the surviving people must be screened, right, to help find out why. Okay, the electrocardiogram, as you know, is simply we use a machine and we connect these electrodes to the limbs, as well as covering the heart. And what it's really doing is just monitoring the electrical activity of the heart, right? If there's a structural problem disrupting that electrical activity, we see it in an abnormal screening. Now, in many hospitals, I'm showing this in particular for Dirk, because Dirk and I have had discussions about this, because now what happens is that the ECGs the machine can read the ECG, right? And as you can see, the machine says it's a normal ECG, right? There's a P wave there, atrial contraction, this is ventricular contraction and ventricular repolarization. So often the ECGs can say normal sinus rhythm and so on. Yeah. Dirk, what do you think? Do you think this ECG is normal? Yeah, this ECG is abnormal, okay, but in fact is diagnostic of a very lethal form of cardiomyopathy. Can you see the T-wave inversion in V1 is not allowed, okay? And then secondly, if you look carefully here, Dirk, there's this reverberation here. It's called an epsilon wave. It's classic for arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. Can you see now why the Crookes scale will switch off the computer? Okay, because doctors and many people tend to trust the machine rather than the person. Okay, fine. The ECG must be read by a competent physician. And here, I'm plumbing here for my profession, by a cardiologist who knows how to read it. This is a very abnormal ECG. Okay, fine. Which was passed as normal, and if people are not reading this, it's key. So it's key here. It's a key, very key idea. Screening requires technology, but it requires people who know how to interpret the technology, right? And often that expertise is rare, okay? Right? It resides in very few centers, and certainly not in the private sector. I don't know if there's someone in the private sector here in South Africa, right? It resides in the public sector, because as you know, the public sector is the pace setter of the system. That's where the depth of expertise resides, okay? That's a debate for another day. But those are key points, very key points, and they're very important in the minds of the public, right? Because the public sometimes are infatuated with technology, okay? And they don't realize that actually we don't need the MRI for screening, right? I know there are people who advertise and come for this MRI and enter, you know, it will miss this condition. You just need the simple ECG, and then you need a doctor who can interpret it. The ultrasound, as you know, of the heart does require you to lie in this position, and then you get measured. It is less also, the big problem, of course, with it is that it is very, very operator dependent. This person needs to hold this probe in a particular way to get a clean image such as this, which is what we use to measure the thickness of the heart. So for example here, this is the septum of the heart here, which we measure in terms of thickness, and it must all be aligned in a particular way, and then we can make a diagnosis of cardiomyopathy based on the structure. Again, you need a competent center that's able to do this. So screening will identify most cardiac abnormalities. And in the UK, for example, 12 young people die suddenly each week from previously undetected heart conditions. So we ought to be making the public aware of the screening issue. It helps, in fact, in sport by raising awareness of symptoms among coaches and physiotherapists and others who often tend to push the athletes to their limits. We need to say to them that, look, you know, we need to balance that, you know, with just being sure that the athlete can take the stress that they are being put through. And of course, it's part of health education of young people about looking at other aspects of health. And it raises awareness throughout sport about sudden cardiac death and highlight families who are most at risk and those who've already had a young person being affected from this condition. The question, of course, I think that all of us are asking, but what is in this for me as a person now sitting in the audience? This is a very important slide here that I will show you before we finish. It is an experiment that was done in Italy, right? Where in 1981, screening of competitive athletes became mandatory, right? You had to have this before you were allowed. You had to produce a certificate before you are allowed to participate in those sports. And it's one of the few countries where this is a requirement, okay? And they introduced screening at this point. Now, what I'm showing you here on this axis is what we would call the incidence of sudden deaths, okay? So, for example, at the time when they started screening among athletes, competitive athletes, the rate of sudden death was 3.5 per 100,000 athletes per year. That was the rate. So they introduced screening at that particular point. And they stopped a lot of people from participating in sport. And they could measure, actually, at a population level, that the frequency of sudden unexpected death in athletes by the year 2004, it was lower than the general public. This is the unscreened public. People are not athletes. People are like most of us, you know, who don't take those risks. So by screening in this particular population, they showed that it works, right? It's one of the great arguments for this. It does remain controversial, but I think there are very few people who argue against this data, which then helps us to really answer a couple of questions. So competitive athletes must be screened, and then of course, if there has been a young, sudden, unexpected death within a family, we need to undergo screening. But what about you and me in the audience? We're not athletes, okay? We're just leading our normal lives. Screening is, in fact, an issue there too, particularly when you've got symptoms. It is in symptomatic people where the yield is quite high. So if you've got chest pain, particularly if it is exercise related, it's better to be safe than sorry when you've got chest pain, right? Yeah, you do need to be screened this to make sure that it's not indicative of cardiac condition. You need not wait until the pain is just is real angina, okay? That is related to effort, okay? Because sometimes heart pain can occur at rest, and the one that occurs at rest is often a malignant form of the condition. When you become breathless, of course, you do need to be seen to make sure that you have not got a cardiomyopathy or developing a heart failure so that we can get there early. We need to pick up people who are overusing their allotment of the heart rate, who are having palpitations, and they're able, you can detect when your heart is going fast all of the time. You know, we call that palpitations. When you've got palpitations, you must just make sure that it is okay, right, by screening. And then, of course, dizziness is not good, and fainting and blackouts do need to be sorted out. So these are the symptoms that do require us not to ignore them and just to be screened, and then you will be examined by a doctor, and then the doctor will take in multiple factors, restratify you, family history and other issues, and of course do that ECG to see if there isn't something that is lurking there. So ladies and gentlemen, with those few words, I'd like to stop here, and I think we have a little bit of time for discussions. Thank you. If possible, if at all possible, by a doctor who's actually trained in reading ECGs. We do in this country, particularly in our department, make sure that junior doctors are trained and they become quite good. And then, as I say, we switched off the computer. Okay, so now they have to really learn to read the ECG. Whereas in many places, actually, you know, people just look, oh, what does the computer say? And don't apply their minds as they should.
Point being that many GPs offer the service. They say, come to me, I'll give you a checkup, do an ECG. You go along and you do that. How satisfactory is that?
Our doctors, our GPs, are actually well-trained. And you need to have that discussion with your GP about the experience really in reading ECGs without relying on the computer, and whether there's a need. You need to put that to the doctor, whether there's a need for someone else to check. A lot of our GPs who've been in practice for a long time, who've undergone good training, right, are quite competent. But whenever there's doubt on the part of your GP in terms of his or her skills, then it's a good idea to just have that ECG reviewed by a cardiologist. And other cardiologists, particularly us in the hospital, we often ask that just the ECG be emailed or scanned or faxed, right? And then we would then report on it. We will just give the GP a report on the ECG. So there's always help is available. I think the lady there, and then we'll move this way. Yes, very good point. This problem of deaths in these triathlons is being recognized more and more as a problem. And it would seem that the triathlon itself, in terms of incidence of sudden death, may be higher than the other sports, right? So it seems. So that's the first thing. The second problem, you're right, 90% of the deaths occur in the swimming phase of the race. And as to why that should be, people have come up with quite a number of possibilities for that, one of which is that it is, in fact, the most challenging part of a triathlon from a physiology point of view, right? So you get in there, the water is cold, so there's a change in temperature, right? That has an effect on your sympathetic system, over and above the exercise itself. You are being subjected to quite a dramatic change in temperature. And people, when they practice, they usually actually are practicing in the pool. Whereas in the triathlon, you go to a lake where there are waves, and so it's a much more challenging. There are lots of people; they're on top of each other. But one of the great problems is that when someone runs into difficulty in the water, it's not easy to get to them quickly, right? Whereas people do get into difficulty in the other parts, and they stop, and it's difficult when you are in there, when you are now really exhausted, to just stop. You know, you're in the middle there of the ocean, you've got to, you know, of the lake or whatever is being used. You better get going, right? So we are not sure about the real reason, but there really are multiple factors associated with that part of the race that compound the situation and really make it difficult for us to rescue people even when they're in trouble. Yeah. So there's no doubt that swimming part is the danger part. Yes, and then we'll move this way.
Could you tell us what medical indications, criteria you would use to advise somebody to have an implant cardiac converter?
Yes. That's a very good question. Clearly, if you've been resuscitated from a sudden death episode, right, regardless of the underlying reason for it, it is indicated, right? So we call that secondary prevention. Now you really declared yourself as very high risk. So that's clear. And then secondly, we now need to make a diagnosis. Try to make a diagnosis as to what is the underlying condition. Okay, if you've had a heart attack and your ventricle has been damaged and your pumping function is less than 35%. That's an indication, right? Yeah. So you are at risk as an indication. If you have heart failure, right, due to dilated cardiomyopathy, okay, and your ECG shows widening of the conduction, right, we call it the QRS, and you're not thriving on medical therapy, you need a device put in, right, to synchronize your heart. But in addition to that, it is quite clear that when you add an implantable cardioverter defibrillator function to that pacemaker that this person no doubt needs, it improves outcome. In long QT syndrome, right, in those markedly prolonged QT, as was shown here, were really at high risk. On the basis of many reasons, you might want to put in primarily, although Peter Schwartz will tell you that we must start with beta blockers. Okay, there's a European approach which he presented, which is let's start with pills, and then, you know, because they work well, and he's right, and then come in with ICDs. Whereas perhaps if you were in Boston, you know, they will put in the ICD and then try the pills on top of it. So that's the issue right here. So we need to make a diagnosis, right, so that we can see whether you meet the criteria for implantation of this. And now there have been quite a lot of trials in this field which give us confidence about who benefits and who does not benefit from having an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. Yes. Yes, sir.
Would you recommend putting in the defibrillator?
Yes. The whole issue of resuscitating people is a very, very important one that we have not begun to address in this country. Firstly, we need to make sure that everybody, all of us, are trained in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, okay? So that we can respond quickly to someone who collapses. That's the first thing, right? The second thing here, the Vice Chancellor here must install external defibrillators at frequent locations here. I have not seen them. Perhaps the Vice Chancellor is banking on the fact there's a lot of young people here. Perhaps the risk is lower. So in public places, We need to have it in airports and so on, where large numbers of people are congregating. We need to have that. And then we need to train, we need to train people in how to use them simply. Right? And then third issue, obviously, is in a home, particularly if you've got a high-risk individual in the home, and then you can be trained in how to use it and how to apply it. Okay? Yeah, so it's a great public health issue. Which is a huge problem. There are certain parts of the world that do it well, like the city of Seattle, where really they do this very well. They model this approach to sudden cardiac death on a population level by making sure that large numbers of people are trained in CPR, that there are external defibrillators in places where large numbers of people congregate, that the ambulance system responds, you know, in good time to people who are in trouble and so on. So it's a whole system that you do need to build to make sure that we deal with this problem. I think in this country, we still have other great problems, such as, you know, HIV and AIDS and TB. We seem to be overcoming them. So I think the chance is coming that some of these other issues must also be attended to systematically. Yes, ma'am. Fortunately, we have Dr. Dirk Long here, who has thought about this matter far more than I had. I just drink the red wine, but I'll ask Dirk to just comment on that issue. It's a great question.
Okay, so alcohol, do we drink it? Basically, if you were to apply to the Medicines Control Council to license alcohol as a drug, and then if you were sort of in a discovery premium plan, you could get KWV, and if you were on the sort of James Gravel option, so you would never get it licensed because the evidence is not that completely convincing. So there's good evidence for alcohol as such. That people who drink moderately, and that's women, one drink a day, or men, up to two drinks a day, have lower rates of cardiac disease, or lower death rates. And in fact, the strongest evidence is irrespective of whatever alcohol it is, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits, doesn't seem to make that much of a difference. Now, one can argue a lot about what causes those things. Some people think, you know, if you're sick, you don't drink, and therefore the people who drink moderately are maybe a little bit intrinsically more healthy, etc. That might be true, but I think that moderate alcohol reduces heart disease to an extent is correct, because we see moderate alcohol increases your HDL cholesterol, your good cholesterol. You know, so that is probably the biological effect of moderate alcohol consumption. Then, you know, Stellenbosch Farmers Winery and everybody else is trying to convince you that red wine is better than anything else. And that's because of, you know, the polyphenols and the antioxidants and resveratrol and all kinds of other things that are found in the red wine. What makes studying that extremely difficult is that wine consumption is a marker of a lot of other things like socioeconomic status, healthful behavior, more frequent exercise. Like what they've done in Denmark, they've analyzed all the supermarket checkout slips. So you can buy wine in the supermarket and beer. And then they see people that buy beer tend to buy more fatty meats, more salty snacks. People who buy wine buy more fish and other things. So it becomes very difficult to dissect out how much of the alleged superior benefit of wine is due to the wine itself, you know, what's or just everything else that goes with it. But you know, to reduce all of that to a nutshell, yes, modest alcohol consumption will reduce your rate. I don't think there's anything magical about every second day or every day. in reality, certainly in South Africa, we see much more harm caused by alcohol than benefit. You know, so I would never stand up and publicly kind of say, thou shalt drink alcohol. And I don't recommend alcohol to people who don't drink. Because, you know, they have their own reasons. Their fathers or mothers might have been alcoholic, or we don't know if they have personality that's prone. So if people drink, my main sort of thrust is to check that their drinking is not dangerous. And if that's okay, then yes, I'll be happy for them to continue to consume that alcohol. But I'm never going to say to them, please drink a glass of wine every day. If they ask me, can I do that, I'm very happy, and yes, it will probably give your mind a benefit. But the one danger that we see sometimes is that people say, okay, I'll drink my glass of wine, and I won't take my statin. You know, if you need, you know, sort of that, you think you're kind of replacing the one with the other. So if your risk is high enough that you need a drug, then you should take the drug, and then you can add the wine in if you want to. you know, we're talking about, we're not talking about the fancy restaurant glasses, you know, half a liter, that's 150, 200 mils.
Yes.
Somewhere around there.
Yes, sir. Also, very, very good question. So, when we are saying, when we're using the word screening, we're talking generally about somebody who is well, but at risk of a particular condition. Right? So screening, and then we said that among young people, the key there is to screen those who are in competitive sports because their risk is increased. To screen those where there's a family history of an unexplained sudden death before the age of 35. So that's one. And then, among older individuals, if you are healthy and have not been diagnosed with any condition, and you've got certain symptoms, right? Okay, so you're a healthy person, no diagnosis, and then you've got symptoms, then it is, in fact, a good idea to just be screened to make sure that that symptom is not indicative of a underlying condition that could put you at risk for sudden death. Okay, so that's when we talk screening, we're actually referring to healthy people. People who have already had a diagnosis of heart disease, right? Screening does not apply there. You already had the diagnosis, right? What applies in that person now is for us to reduce the risk of a bad event from happening. And then it becomes now an issue of giving you those treatments that prolong life, giving you those interventions if you're at high risk for VF, for ventricular fibrillation, that will stop it. So it's a very important idea. So screening is for people who are otherwise healthy. Once you've got the condition, it's now an issue of treatment. And you don't need, we don't need to repeat that ECG on you again, okay? And we don't even need to repeat that echo again. You just need to go and talk to your doctor. You've had a heart attack perhaps 5 years ago, and then the doctor's job is to make sure that your diet is appropriate, you are physically active, you are taking the medications perhaps that you need that will prolong life and help with symptoms if there are symptoms, and then you are having the additional interventions that are proven to prolong life if you need them.
So maybe just to come back to the ECG and coronary artery disease. For coronary artery disease, an ECG, a standard ECG, is unfortunately a very poor screening test, because, you know, the problem of that clot sitting in the wall, the heart might get sufficient blood, your ECG could be completely normal. So, you know, the kind of question people often ask, they come to you and they say, you know, you've listened to your, my heart and you've done the ECG, is my heart okay? You know, and the answer to that is probably your heart muscle is okay, but we don't actually know what is happening in your coronary arteries, unfortunately. So an ECG doesn't give you complete reassurance. It tells you you haven't had a heart attack and, you know, you have got a lot of other things. But if you're looking at coronary artery disease, it can't sort of give you a clean bill of health just on the ECG. So one mustn't put a false value on that test. And even if you do a stress ECG, that might also be normal because you're not obstructing the lumen. You know, so that's why, you know, maybe it sort of came across that, you know, ECG in coronary artery is very important for diagnosis and finding out, but not such an important screening tool. You know, so we wouldn't go and do ECGs on everybody, you know, at 50 and then only, you know, not test the cholesterol or something if the ECG were normal.
Yeah. Yes, so we'll probably take two questions and then call it a day. There was there's the lady.
Sort of I just want someone to do a very high cholesterol and
Yes, so the ECG is not the only way to determine whether there's a heart attack. So, for example, in that situation, I want to know if they tested for the enzymes that leak from a damaged muscle, right? So in other words, there are a number of ways of making a diagnosis of heart attack. And of course, if you know, there's a rise in the enzymes, and you believe that it's a there's a heart attack, you then treat. Although the ECG is very you know, determines actually what you do. If there is an abnormality with ST elevation and the person came in early, then there's a clear indication there to do an angiogram. You know, right. So in that particular case, from what you tell me, it does not look like there was an absolute indication for the angiogram. You know, you must remember the angiogram does not necessarily save your life. You know, just having the angiogram itself necessarily. So it's very difficult, of course, for me to give an absolute opinion there. But from what you tell me, it does not look like there was an absolute indication to take the person to angiography there and then. Good. Right. Yes, ma'am. Yes, and you're saying in the family there's a known, but okay, it again depends on what type of heart disease. Is heart disease related to high cholesterol?
Okay.
And Dirk maybe can comment on that. So when they are, I mean, young children, the key there is to just make sure that diet is appropriate. They are not going to increase their risk more than is necessary.
But they can live their whole life without knowing it, can they? Unless I have them screened.
Dirk, you want to comment on that one?
Yeah, look, obviously, again, Bongani is going back to, you were saying you need to make a diet. Yeah, we also need to try and see what is causing the heart disease in the family. Is it one of those inherited high cholesterol forms? then it's pretty easy. We check the children's cholesterol and the either got it or they haven't. You know, and you know, then we know how to deal with it. Sometimes it's a bit more difficult, you know, so we see clustering of heart disease in families, but we don't necessarily have one single thing that we can pinpoint.
Yeah.
You know, but I would think if there's a lot of heart disease in the family, not unreasonable to look at cholesterol, you know, maybe blood pressure and a few other things, just to see if there's anything identifiable that one can pick up and do something about. It might not necessarily be drugs, you know, depending on the age of the child, etc., but it is worthwhile.
So, is the heart disease early onset in the family, before the age of 40?
Some members of the family, yes, others older. Okay.
The other thing that I often see that what happens is everybody gets excited about the children, but there could be a brother or an uncle or whatever in that family who's like 20 years older and who's just so many steps closer, or even the parents. You know, so just as a little extra thing, you know, sometimes we just worry a little bit too much about the children and don't think about the parents. And we see that, for instance, in our children, we've got this double dose cholesterol where their cholesterol is 20. You know, everybody's so worried and excited that we forget, yes, mom has got a cholesterol of 10 and dad has got a cholesterol of 10. And if we don't do something about them, they're not going to be there for that child.
It's just that all the adults really have been screened.
Okay. So if that's been done, I think it's not unreasonable to have a look and see if one can identify something.
Good. No, thank you very much. I think we will close the seminar.